it. Sam doesn't even like to mention her dad. This guy stamps Loki's symbol on all his work. No accounting for taste, Jack said. Once I made a throwing dagger with a green acrylic grip. Can you imagine? I picked up the photo of the three Chase siblings. But sometime during the last week, that same Loki symbol appeared on my uncle's face. Any thoughts? Jack planted the tip of his blade in the living room carpet. He bent forward until his hilt was an inch from the photo. Maybe he was getting nearsighted. Near-hilted? Hmm, he said. You want my opinion? Yeah. I think that's pretty strange. I waited for more. Jack did not elaborate. Okay, then, I said. You don't think maybe there's a connection between, I don't know, another child of Loki showing up in Valhalla and this weird mark on Randall's face and the fact that suddenly, after a couple of months of quiet, we have to find Thor's hammer right away to avoid some invasion? When you put it like that, Jack said, you're right, it's very strange. But Loki is always showing up in weird places, and Thor's hammer... Jack vibrated in place like he was either shuddering or suppressing a laugh. Mjolnir is always getting misplaced. I swear, Thor needs to have that hammer duct taped to his face. I doubted I would be getting that image out of my head anytime soon. How can Thor lose it so easily? How could anyone steal it? I thought Mjolnir was so heavy nobody else could pick it up. Common misconception, Jack said. Forget all that only the worthy can lift it stuff from the movies. The hammer is heavy. But you get enough giants together? Sure, they can lift it. Now wielding it, throwing it correctly, catching it again, summoning lightning with it, that takes some skill. But I've lost count of the number of times Thor has fallen asleep in some forest, prankster giants have rolled up in a backhoe loader, and the next thing you know, the thunder god is hammerless. Most of the time he gets it back quickly, kills the pranksters, and lives happily ever after. But not this time. Jack wobbled back and forth, his version of a shrug. I suppose getting Mjolnir back is important. The hammer is powerful, inspires fear in the giants, smashes entire armies, keeps the forces of evil from destroying the universe and whatever. Personally, I've always found him kind of a bore. He just sits there most of the time, doesn't say a word, and don't ever invite him to karaoke night at the Nuclear Rainbow. Disaster. I completely had to carry both parts on Love Never Felt So Good. I wondered if Jack's blade was sharp enough to cut off the too much information he was giving me. I guessed not. Last question, I said. Halfborn mentioned that this new child of Loki was an Argur. You have any idea? I love Argurs! Jack somersaulted with glee, nearly slicing off my nose. Phrase fripperies! We have an Argur across the hall! That's great news! One time we were Midgard, me and Frey and a couple of elves, right? It was like 3 in the morning, and this Argur walked up to us. Jack howled with laughter, his runes pulsing in full Saturday Night Fever mode. Oh, wow, that was an epic night. But what exactly? Someone knocked on the door. TJ poked his head in.
Magnus, sorry to bother. Oh, hey, Jack, what's up?
TJ, Jack said. You recovered from last night? TJ chuckled, though he looked embarrassed. Just about. I frowned. You guys went partying last night? Oh, senor, Jack chided. You really need to come out with us. You haven't lived until you've gone clubbing with a Civil War bayonet. TJ cleared his throat. So anyway, I came to get you, Magnus. The battle's about to start. I looked around for a clock, then remembered I didn't have one. Isn't it early? It's Thursday, TJ reminded me. I cursed. Thursdays were special and complicated. I hated them. Let me grab my gear. Also, TJ said, the Hotel Ravens have tracked down our new hallmate. I thought we should probably go be with him. They're bringing him to the battle, whether he wants to be there or not. Chapter 6. Love Me Some Weasel Soup. Thursday meant dragons, which meant an even more painful death than usual. I would have brought Jack, but one, he thought practice battles were beneath him, and two, he had a hot date with a polearm. By the time TJ and I arrived at the battlefield, the fighting had already started. Armies streamed into the hotel's interior courtyard, a topographical killing zone big enough to be its own sovereign country with woods, meadows, rivers, hills, and mock villages. On all four sides, soaring into the hazy white fluorescent sky, tiers of gold-rimmed balconies overlooked the field. From the upper levels, catapults hurled fiery projectiles toward the warriors below like deadly ticker tape. The blare of horns echoed through the forests. Plumes of smoke rose from burning huts. Inharyar charged into the river, fighting on horseback, laughing as they cut each other down. And, because it was Thursday, a dozen large dragons had also joined the slaughter. The older Inharyar called them lindworms. If you ask me, that made them sound like a mildly annoying skin rash. Instead, lindworms were the size and length of 18-wheelers. They had just two front legs with leathery brown bat-type wings too small for effective flight. Mostly they dragged themselves across the ground, occasionally flapping, leaping, or swooping down on their prey. From a distance, with their brown, green, and ochre hides, they looked like an angry flock of giant carnivorous turkey snakes. But trust me, up close, they were bad news. Our goal for Thursday's battle? Stay alive as long as possible while the dragons tried very hard not to let us. Spoiler, the dragons always won. Mallory and Halfborn waited for us at the edge of the field. Halfborn was adjusting the straps on Mallory's armor. "You're doing it wrong," she growled. "That's too tight across the shoulders."
"Woman, I've been putting on armor for centuries."
"When? You always go into battle bare-chested."
"Are you complaining about that?" Halfborn asked.
Mallory blushed. "Shut up."
"Ah, look, here's Magnus and TJ."
Halfborn clapped me on the shoulder, dislocating several of my joints.
"Floor 19 is accounted for."
Technically, that wasn't true. Floor 19 had almost 100 residents, but our particular corridor, our neighborhood within the neighborhood, consisted of us four. Plus, of course, the newest resident.
"Where's the cheetah?" TJ asked.
As if on cue, a raven dive-bombed us. It dropped a burlap bag at my feet, then landed nearby, flapping its wings and croaking angrily. The burlap bag moved. A long, skinny animal squirmed out of it. A brown and white weasel. The weasel hissed. The raven cawed. I didn't speak raven, but I was pretty sure it was telling the weasel, "Behave yourself or I will peck your weaselly eyes out." TJ pointed his rifle at the animal. "You know, when the 54th Massachusetts was marching toward Derry in Georgia, we used to shoot weasels and cook them in a soup. Tasty stuff. You guys think I should get out my old recipe?" The weasel transformed. I heard so much about this new recruit being a monster that I half expected him to turn into a living corpse like the goddess Hell or a miniature version of the sea serpent Jormungand. Instead, the animal grew into a regular human teen, long and lanky, with a swirl of dyed green hair, black at the roots, like a plug of weeds pulled out of a lawn. The weasel's brown and white fur changed into green and pink clothes, battered rose high tops, skinny lime green corduroy pants, a pink and green argyle sweater vest over a white tee, and another pink cashmere sweater wrapped around the waist like a kilt. The outfit reminded me of a jester's motley, or the coloration of a venomous animal warning the whole world, "Try me and you die." The newcomer looked up, and I forgot how to breathe. It was Loki's face, except younger. The same wry smile and sharp features, the same unearthly beauty, but without the scarred lips or the acid burns across the nose. And those eyes. One dark brown, the other pale amber. I'd forgotten the term for that, having different colored irises. My mom would have called it David Bowie eyes. I called it completely unnerving. The weirdest thing of all? I was pretty sure I had seen this kid before. Yeah, I know. You're thinking a kid like that would stand out. How could I not remember exactly where we'd cross paths? But when you live on the streets, wild-looking people are normal. Only normal people stand out as strange. The kid flashed a perfect white smile at TJ, though there was no warmth in those eyes. "Point that rifle somewhere else, or I'll wrap it around your neck like a bow tie." Something told me this was not an idle threat. The kid might actually know how to tie a bow tie, which was kind of scary arcane knowledge. TJ laughed. He also lowered his rifle. "We didn't get a chance to introduce ourselves earlier, when you were trying to kill us. I'm Thomas Jefferson, Jr. This is Mallory Keene, Halfborn Gunderson, and Magnus Chase." The newcomer just stared at us. Finally, the raven made an irritated squawk. "Yeah, yeah," the kid told the bird. "Like I said, I'm calmer now. You didn't mess me up, so it's all cool." "Squeak!" The kid sighed. "Fine, I'll introduce myself. I'm Alex Fierro. Pleased to meet you all, I guess. Mr. Raven, you can go now. I promise not to kill them unless I have to." The raven ruffled his feathers. He gave me the stink eye like, "It's your problem now, buddy." Then he flew away. Halfborn grinned.
"Well, that's settled. Now that you've promised not to kill us, let's start killing other people."
Mallory crossed her arms. "He doesn't even have a weapon."
"She,"
Alex corrected.
"What?"
Mallory asked. "Call me She, unless and until I tell you otherwise."
"But..."
"She it is," TJ interceded. "I mean, she is. He rubbed his neck as if still worrying about a rifle bow tie.
Let's get to battle!
Alex rose to her feet. I'll admit that I was staring. Suddenly, my whole perspective had flipped inside out, like when you look at an inkblot picture and see just the black part. Then your brain inverts the image and you realize the white part makes an entirely different picture, even though nothing has changed. That was Alex Fierro, except in pink and green. A second ago, he had been very obviously a boy to me. Now she was very obviously a girl.
What? She demanded.
Nothing, I lied. Above us, more ravens began to circle, cawing accusingly.
We'd better get moving, Halfborn said. The ravens don't like slackers on the battlefield.
Mallory drew her knives and turned toward Alex.
Come on then, sweetheart. Let's see what you can do.
Chapter 7. Have you or someone you love ever suffered from lindworms? We waded into combat like one happy family. Well, except for the fact that TJ grabbed my arm and whispered,
Keep an eye on her, will you? I don't want to get mauled from behind.
So I brought up the rear with Alex Fierro. We moved inland, picking our way through a field of corpses, all of whom we would see later, alive at dinner time. I could have taken some pretty funny photos, but camera phones were heavily discouraged on the field of combat. You know how it is. Somebody snaps a picture of you dead in an embarrassing pose, it makes the popular page on Instagram, then you get teased about it for centuries. Halfborn and Mallory chopped us a path through a pack of berserkers. TJ shot Charlie Flanagan in the head. Charlie thinks it is hilarious to get shot in the head. Don't ask me why. We dodged a volley of fiery tar balls from the balcony catapults. We had a brief sword battle with Big Lou from floor 401. Great guy, but he always wants to die by decapitation. That's hard, since Lou is almost 7 feet tall. He seeks out Halfborn Gunderson on the battlefield, since Halfborn is one of the few in Harriar tall enough to oblige. Somehow, we made it to the edge of the woods without getting stomped by a lindworm. TJ, Mallory, and Halfborn fanned out in front and led us into the shadows of the trees. I moved warily through the underbrush, my shield up, my standard-issue combat sword heavy in my left hand. The sword wasn't nearly as well-balanced or as lethal as Jack, but it was a lot less talkative. Next to me, Alex strolled along, apparently unconcerned that she was empty-handed and the most brightly colored target in our group. After a while, the silence got to me. I've seen you before, I told her. Were you at the youth shelter on Winter Street? She sniffed. I hated that place. Yeah, I lived on the streets for 2 years. She arched her eyebrow, which made her amber left eye look paler and colder. You think that makes us friends? Everything about her posture said, Get away from me. Hate me or whatever, I don't care as long as you leave me alone. But I'm a contrary person. On the streets, plenty of homeless folks had acted belligerent toward me and pushed me away. They didn't trust anybody. Why should they? That just made me more determined to get to know them. The loners usually had the best stories. They were the most interesting and the savviest about staying alive. Sam, a la boss, must have had some reason for bringing this kid to Valhalla. I wasn't going to let Fierro off the hook just because she had startling eyes, an impressive sweater vest, and a tendency to hit people. What did you mean earlier, I asked, when you said, Call me she? I'm gender fluid and transgender, idiot. Look it up if you need to, but it's not my job to educate.
That's not what I meant.
Oh, please, I saw your mouth hanging open. Well, yeah, maybe for a second, I was surprised, but I wasn't sure how to continue without sounding like even more of an idiot. The gender thing wasn't what surprised me. A huge percentage of the homeless teens I'd met had been assigned one gender at birth but identified as another, or they felt like the whole boy-girl binary didn't apply to them. They ended up on the streets because, shocker, their families didn't accept them. Nothing says tough love like kicking your non-heteronormative kid to the curb so they can experience abuse, drugs, high suicide rates, and constant physical danger. Thanks, Mom and Dad. What surprised me was the way I'd reacted to Alex. How fast my impression of her had slingshot and the kind of emotions that had stirred up. I wasn't sure I could put that into words without turning as red as Mallory Keene's hair.
What I was saying, is when you were talking to the raven, you mentioned you were worried you'd been messed up. What did you mean?
Alex looked like I'd just offered her a huge wedge of Limburger cheese.
Maybe I overreacted. I wasn't expecting to die today or get scooped up by some Valkyrie.
That was Sam. She's okay. Alex shook her head.
I don't forgive her. I got here and found out... Whatever. I'm dead. Immortal.
I'll never age and never change. I thought that meant... Her voice frayed. It doesn't matter.
I was pretty sure it mattered. I wanted to ask her about life in Midgard, why she had an outdoor atrium just like mine in her suite, why all the pottery, why she would want to put the mark of Loki next to her initials on her work. I wondered if her arrival was just a coincidence, or whether it had something to do with the mark on Uncle Randolph's face in the photo and our sudden urgent need to find Thor's hammer. On the other hand, I suspected that if I tried to ask her all that, she would turn into a mountain gorilla and rip my face off. Happily, I was spared that fate when a lindworm crash-landed in front of us. The monster hurtled out of the sky, flapping its ridiculous wings and roaring like a grizzly bear with a 100-watt amp. Trees cracked and splintered under its weight as it landed in our midst.
Arrgh! Halfborn yelled, which was Old Norse for, "Holy crud, there's a dragon," just before the lindworm smacked him into the sky.
Judging from the arc, Halfborn Gunderson was going to end up somewhere around floor 29, which would be a surprise to anyone relaxing on their balcony. TJ fired his rifle. Gunsmoke blossomed harmlessly against the dragon's chest. Mallory yelled a curse in Gaelic and charged. The lindworm ignored her and turned toward me. I should mention, lindworms are ugly, like if Freddy Krueger and a Walking Dead zombie had a child. That kind of ugly. Their faces have no flesh or hide, just a carapace of bone and exposed tendons, gleaming fangs, and dark sunken eye sockets. When the monster opened its maw, I could see straight down its rotten meat-colored throat. Alex crouched, her hands fumbling for something at her belt. This isn't good.
No kidding, my hand was so sweaty I could barely hold my sword. You go right, I'll go left, we'll flank it.
No, I mean that isn't just any dragon. That's Grimwolf, one of the ancient worms. I stared up into the monster's dark eye sockets. He did seem bigger than most of the lindworms I'd fought. But I was usually too busy dying to ask a dragon its age or name.
How do you know? I asked. And why would anybody call a dragon Grimwolf?
The lindworm hissed, filling the air with a scent like burning tires. Apparently he was sensitive about his name. Mallory stabbed at the dragon's legs, screaming more angrily the longer the lindworm ignored her.
Are you two going to help? She called back at us. Or just stand there and chat?
TJ stabbed at the monster with his bayonet. The point just bounced off the creature's ribs. Being a good soldier, TJ backed up and tried again. Alex tugged some sort of cord from her belt loops, a dull steel wire no thicker than a kite string with simple wooden dowels on either end for handles.
Grimwolf is one of the dragons that live at the roots of Yggdrasil. He shouldn't be here.
No one would be crazy enough to. Her face blanched, her expression hardening as if turning into lindworm bone.
He sent it for me. He knows I'm here.
Who? I demanded. What?
Distract him, she ordered. She leaped into the nearest tree and began to climb.
Even without turning into a gorilla, she could definitely move like one.
I took a shaky breath.
Distract him. Sure. The dragon snapped at Alex, biting off several tree branches. Alex moved fast, scampering higher up the trunk. But one or two more snaps and she'd be in lindworm lunchable. Meanwhile, Mallory and TJ were still hacking away at the creature's legs and belly, but they were having no luck convincing the dragon to eat them.
It's only a practice battle, I told myself.
Charge in there, Magnus. Get yourself killed like a pro. That was the whole point of daily combat. To learn to fight any foe, to overcome our fear of death, because on the day of Ragnarok, we need all the skill and courage we could muster.
So why did I hesitate?
First, I'm way better at healing than I am at fighting. Oh, and running away. I'm really good at that. Also, it's hard to charge straight to your own demise, even if you know it won't be permanent. Especially if that demise involves large amounts of pain. The dragon snapped at Alex again, missing her rose high tops by an inch. As much as I hated dying, I hated even more seeing my comrades get killed. I screamed, "Frey!" and ran at the lindworm. Just my luck. Grimwolf was happy to turn his attention to me. When it comes to drawing aggro from ancient monsters, I've got the golden touch. Mallory stumbled back out of my way, chucking one of her knives at the dragon's head. TJ also retreated, yelling, "All yours, buddy!" As far as encouraging words you might hear before an excruciating death go, those sucked pretty bad. I raised my shield and sword like the nice instructors had demonstrated in Viking 101. The dragon's mouth opened wide, revealing several extra rows of teeth, just in case the outer row of teeth didn't kill me dead enough. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Alex swaying at the top of the tree, a tense bundle of pink and green, ready to spring. I realized what she was planning. She wanted to jump onto the dragon's neck. That was such a stupid plan, it made me feel better about my own stupid way of dying. The dragon struck. I jabbed my sword upward, hoping to impale the monster's upper palate. Instead, a sudden pain blinded me. My face felt like it had been doused with industrial cleaning fluid. My knees buckled, which probably saved my life. The dragon bit empty air where my head had been a millisecond before. Somewhere to my left, Mallory screamed, "Get up, you fool!" I tried to blink away the pain. It only got worse. My nostrils filled with the stench of burning flesh. Grimrolf recovered his balance, snarling with irritation. Inside my head, a familiar voice said, "Come now, my friend, don't struggle." My vision doubled. I could still see the forest, the dragon looming over me, a small pink-green figure leaping toward the monster from the top of a tree. But there was another layer to reality, a gauzy white scene trying to burn its way through my corneas. I knelt in Uncle Randall's study in the Chase family mansion in Back Bay. Standing over me was someone much worse than a lindworm. Loki, the god of evil. He grinned down at me. "There we are. How nice." At the same time, the dragon Grimrolf struck again, opening his maw to devour me whole. Chapter 8. I am saved from certain death by being killed. I'd never existed in two places at once before. I decided I didn't like it. Through the pain, I was dimly aware of the fight in the forest. Grimrolf was about to bite me in half when suddenly his head bucked upward. Now Alex was straddling his neck, pulling her cord so tight around the dragon's throat that he thrashed and stuck out his forked black tongue. TJ and Mallory rushed in front of me, acting as a shield. They yelled at Grimrolf, waving their weapons and trying to hurt him back. I wanted to help them. I wanted to get to my feet or at least roll out of the way, but I was paralyzed, on my knees, trapped between Valhalla and my Uncle Randolph's study.
"I told you, Randolph," Loki's voice dragged me further into the vision. "See? Blood is thicker than water. We have a solid connection."
The hazy white scene resolved into full color. I knelt on the oriental carpet in front of Randolph's desk, sweating in the square of sunlight that was tinted green from the stained glass transom. The room smelled of lemon wood polish and burning meat. I was pretty sure the second odor was coming from my face. In front of me stood Loki, his tousled hair the color of fall foliage, his delicately sculpted face marred by acid burns across his nose and cheekbones and suture scars around his lips. He grinned and spread his arms in delight.
"What do you think of my outfit?"
He was wearing an emerald green tuxedo with a frilly maroon shirt, a paisley bow tie, and a matching cummerbund. If anything about the ensemble could be said to be matching. A price tag dangled from his left coat sleeve. I couldn't speak. I couldn't throw up as much as I wanted to. I couldn't even offer him a free consultation at Blitzen's Best.
"No," Loki's expression soured. "I told you, Randolph. You should have bought me the canary yellow one, too."
A strangled sound came from my throat.
"Magnus," said Uncle Randolph's voice. "Don't listen!"
Loki extended his hand, the ends of his fingers smoking. He didn't touch me, but the pain across my face tripled, as though someone were branding me with an iron. I wanted to collapse, to beg Loki to stop, but I couldn't move. I realized I was seeing everything through my uncle's eyes. I was inhabiting his body, feeling what he was experiencing. Loki was using Randolph as some sort of agony-operated telephone to contact me. The pain eased, but Randolph's extra weight enveloped me like a lead wetsuit. My lungs rattled. My worn-out knees ached. I didn't like being an old man.
Now, Randolph, Loki chided. Behave yourself. Magnus, I apologize about your uncle. Where was I? Oh yes, your invitation.
Meanwhile, in Valhalla, I remained paralyzed on the battlefield while the dragon Grimwolf staggered around, knocking down entire swaths of forest. One of the lindworm's feet caught Mallory Keene, stomping her flat. TJ yelled and waved pieces of his now-broken rifle, trying to draw the monster's attention. Somehow, Alex Fierro managed to stay on the dragon's neck, tightening her cord as Grimwolf whipped back and forth.
"A wedding,"
Loki announced cheerfully. He held up a green invitation, then folded it and tucked it into Randolph's shirt pocket.
"5 days from today. I apologize for the short notice, but I hope you can come, especially since it's up to you to bring the bride and the bride price. Otherwise, well, war, invasion, Ragnarok, etc. A wedding will be much more fun. Now let's see, how much has Samira told you?"
My skull constricted until it felt like my brain would come out of my sinus cavity. A ragged scream escaped my lips, but I wasn't sure if it was mine or Uncle Randolph's. From the dragon's neck, Alex yelled, "What's wrong with Magnus?" TJ ran to my side. "I don't know. His head is smoking. That's bad, right?" "Grab his sword," Alex pulled her cord tighter, causing black blood to trickle down the dragon's neck. "Get ready." "Oh dear." Loki tapped me / Randolph on the nose. The pressure in my head subsided from blackout misery to moderate torture. "Samira hasn't shared. The poor thing is embarrassed, I suppose." "I understand. It's difficult for me, too, giving away my favorite daughter. They grow up so quickly." I tried to speak. I wanted to say, "Go away, you suck! Get out of my head and leave Samira alone!" It came out as, "Gah!"
"No need to thank me," Loki said. "Neither of us wants Ragnarok to start just yet, eh? And I'm the only one who can help you." It wasn't an easy negotiation, but I can be very persuasive. The hammer in exchange for the bride. A one-time offer. I'll tell you more when you secure the bride price.
"Now!" Alex yelled. She pulled her wire so hard the dragon arched his back, separating the segments of armored hide that protected his belly. TJ charged forward and thrust my practice sword into a soft spot below Grimwolf's heart. TJ rolled aside as the monster came down with his full weight, impaling himself. Alex leaped from the lindworm's neck, her garrote dangling from one hand, slick with blood.
"Was that Alex I heard?" Loki curled his scarred lip. "She's not invited to the wedding. She'll ruin everything. In fact," Loki's eyes gleamed with mischief, "give her a little present for me, will you?"
My lungs tightened, even worse than when I was an asthmatic kid. My body began to superheat. I was in so much pain, my organs seemed to be dissolving into molecules, my skin glowing and steaming. Loki was turning my brain to fire, filling me with flashes of memories that weren't mine, centuries of anger and the need for revenge. I tried to push him out of my head. I tried to breathe. Alex Fierro stood over me, frowning. Her face and Loki's melded together.
"Your friend is going to explode," Alex said, as if this were a perfectly normal thing that happened to people.
TJ wiped his brow. "What exactly do you mean, explode?"
"I mean Loki is channeling power through him," Alex said. "It's too much. Magnus will blow up, destroying most of this courtyard."
I gritted my teeth. I managed one word. "Run!"
"It won't help," Alex told me. "Don't worry, I've got a solution."
She stepped forward and calmly wrapped her metal wire around my neck. I managed another word. "Wait!"
"It's the only way to get him out of your head."
Alex's brown and amber eyes were impossible to read. She winked at me. Or maybe that was Loki, his face glowing hazily just under Alex's skin.
"See you soon, Magnus," said the god.
Alex yanked both ends of her garrote and snuffed out my life. Chapter 9. Never take a bubble bath with the decapitated god. "Someone please explain to me why I have to dream when I'm dead." There I was, floating in the darkness of non-existence, minding my own business, trying to get over the fact that I'd just been decapitated. Then, I got dropped into these weird, vivid nightmares. Really annoying. I found myself on a 30-foot yacht in the middle of a storm. The deck heaved. Waves crashed over the bow. Sheets of gray rain slammed into the wheelhouse windows. In the captain's chair sat Uncle Randolph, one hand clenching the wheel, the other strangling his radio handset. His yellow raincoat dripped puddles around his feet. His close-shaved head glistened with salt water. In front of him, the control board's monitors showed nothing but static. "Mayday!" he yelled into the handset like it was a stubborn dog refusing to do a trick. "Mayday, curse you! Mayday!" On the bench behind him, a woman and two young girls huddled together. I'd never known them in life, but I recognized them from photographs in Uncle Randolph's office. Perhaps because I had just been inside Randolph's head, I was able to pull their names from his memories. His wife, Caroline, and his daughters, Aubrey and Emma. Caroline sat in the middle, her dark brown hair plastered against her face, her arms around her daughter's shoulders. "It'll be all right," she told the girls. She glanced at Randolph with a silent accusation. "Why have you done this to us?" Aubrey, the youngest, had the Chase family's wavy blonde hair. Her head was bowed, her face set in deep concentration. She held a model of the yacht in her lap, trying to keep the toy level despite the 15-foot swells that rocked the wheelhouse as if by doing so she could help her father. Emma was not as calm. She looked about 10, with dark hair like her mother's and sad, weary eyes like her father's. Somehow I knew that she'd been the most excited about this trip. She had insisted on coming along for Dad's big adventure, his search for a missing Viking sword that would finally prove his theories. Dad would be a hero. Randolph had not been able to refuse her. Now, though, Emma trembled with fear. The faint scent of urine told me that her bladder was not holding up under the stress. With each pitch of the boat, Emma shrieked and clutched a pendant to her chest, a runestone Randolph had given her for her last birthday. I couldn't see the symbol, but somehow I knew what it was. Othala, inheritance. Randolph saw Emma as his successor, the next great historian archaeologist of the family. "I'll bring us home," Randolph's voice cracked with despair. He had been so sure of his plans and confident about the weather. They would make an easy trip from the harbor. He had done extremely thorough research. He knew the Sword of Summer must lie at the bottom of Massachusetts Bay. He imagined himself making one quick dive. The old gods of Asgard would bless his efforts. He would bring the sword to the surface and lift its blade into the sunlight for the first time in 1,000 years. His family would be there to witness his triumph. Yet here they were, caught in a freak tempest, their yacht being thrown about like the toy in Aubrey's lap. The boat rolled to starboard. Emma screamed. A wall of water engulfed me. I surfaced in a different dream. My disembodied head bobbed up and down in a full bathtub that smelled of strawberry soap and mildewed washcloths. To my right floated a cheerful rubber ducky with worn-away eyes. To my left floated the not-so-cheerful head of the god Mimir. Seaweed and dead minnows swirled in his beard. Bubble bath foam dribbled from his eyes, ears, and nose. "I'm telling you," his voice echoed in the tiled bathroom, "you guys gotta go. And not just because I'm your boss. Destiny demands it." He wasn't talking to me. Next to the tub, sitting on a lovely avocado porcelain commode, was my friend Hearthstone, his shoulders slumped, his expression despondent. He wore his usual black leather coat and pants, a starched white shirt, and a polka-dotted scarf that looked like it had been cut from a Twister game mat. His spiky blonde hair was almost as pale as his face. Hearth gesticulated in sign language, so quickly and with such annoyance that I could only catch some of his words. "Too dangerous. Death. Protect this idiot." He pointed to Blitzen, who leaned against the sink with his arms crossed. The dwarf was as dapper as always in a walnut-colored three-piece suit that matched his skin tone, a bow tie as black as his beard, and a Frank Sinatra-style hat that somehow pulled the whole look together. "We have to go," Blitz insisted. "The kid needs us." I wanted to tell them how much I missed them, how much I wanted to see them, but also that they shouldn't risk their lives for me. Unfortunately, when I opened my mouth, the only thing that came out was a goldfish frantically wriggling its way to freedom. My face pitched forward into the bubbles. When I surfaced again, the dream had changed. I was still a disembodied head, but now I was floating in a massive open jar filled with pickles and vinegar. It was difficult to see through the greenish liquid in the curved glass, but I seemed to be on a bar. Neon drink ads glowed on the walls. Huge, hazy shapes sat hunched on the stools. Laughter and conversation sent ripples through the pickle juice. I didn't spend a lot of time in bars. I certainly didn't spend a lot of time staring at one through a filthy pickle jar. But something about this place seemed familiar. The arrangement of the tables, the diamond-patterned beveled glass window on the opposite wall, even the rack of wine glasses suspended above me like pendant lamps. A new shape moved into my vision. Someone even larger than the patrons and dressed all in white. "Get out!" Her voice was harsh and ragged, as if she spent her spare time gargling gasoline. "All of you, out! I would talk to my brother!" With a lot of grumbling, the crowd dispersed. The bar fell silent except for the sound of a TV somewhere across the room. A sports broadcast, a commentator saying, "Oh, would you look at that, Bill? His head came right off." I took that comment personally. At the far end of the bar, someone else moved, a figure so dark and large I had thought it was just a shadow.
"It's my bar."
His voice was a deep baritone, huffy and wet. If a bull walrus could speak English, he would sound like that.
"Why do you always kick out my friends?"
"Friends?" the woman yelled. "They are your subjects, Thrym, not your friends. Start acting like a king."
"I am," the man said. "I'm going to destroy Midgard."
"Huh, I'll believe that when I see it. If you were a real king, you would have used that hammer immediately rather than hide it away and dither for months about what to do. You certainly wouldn't trade it to that no good..."
"It's an alliance, Thringa.
the man bellowed. I doubted this guy Thrym was really a walrus, but I imagined him hopping from flipper to flipper, his whiskers bristling.
You don't understand how important that is. I need allies in order to take on the human world.
Once I have married Samira Al-Abbas...
Bloop!
I didn't mean to, but as soon as I heard Samira's name, I screamed inside my pickle jar, causing a huge bubble to break the surface of the greasy green liquid.
What was that? Thrym demanded.
The white shape of Thringa loomed over me.
It came from the pickle jar.
She said this like it was the title of a horror film.
Well, kill it, Thrym yelled.
Thringa picked up a bar stool and whacked my jar with it, hurling me against the wall and leaving me on the floor in a puddle of pickles, juice, and broken glass. I woke up in my own bed, gasping for air. My hands flew to my neck. Thank Frey, my head was once again attached to my body. My nostrils still burned from the scent of pickles and strawberry bubble bath. I tried to parse what had just happened. Which parts were real and which were dreams. The dragon Grimwolf, Alex Fierro and her garrote, Loki burning his way inside my head, somehow using Uncle Randolph to get to me, his warning about a wedding in 5 days. All that had actually happened. Unfortunately, my dreams seemed just as concrete. I'd been with Randolph on his boat the day his family had perished. His memories were now tangled with mine. His anguish sat on my chest like a block of steel. His loss of Caroline, Aubrey, and Emma felt as painful to me as the death of my own mother. Worse, in a way, because Randolph had never gotten any kind of closure. He still suffered every hour of every day. The rest of the visions, Hearthstone and Blitzen coming to help me. I should have been elated, but I remembered Hearthstone's frantic signs. Too dangerous. Death. And the scene from the pickle jar. What the hell aim was that? Those mystery siblings, Thrym and Thringa, I was willing to bet 50 pieces of red gold and a falafel dinner that they were giants. The one named Thrym had Thor's hammer and planned on trading it for... I swallowed back pickle-flavored bile. For Sam.
It's up to you to bring the bride and the bride price, Loki had said. An alliance. A one-time offer.
Loki must have been out of his mind. He wanted to help us get Thor's hammer back by marrying off Samira? Why hadn't Sam said anything about this?
The poor thing is embarrassed, Loki had said.
I remembered the urgency in Sam's voice when we'd talked at the cafe, the way her fingers had trembled on her coffee cup. No wonder she needed to find the hammer so badly. It wasn't just to save the world from invasion, blah blah blah. We were always saving the world. Sam wanted to prevent this marriage deal. But why would she even think she'd have to honor such a stupid trade? Loki had no right to tell her what to do. She was betrothed to Ymir. She loved the guy. I would raise an army of Inheriar, magic elves, and well-dressed dwarves and burn down Jotunheim before I let them coerce my friend. Whatever the case, I needed to talk to her again, and soon. I struggled out of bed. My knees still felt worn and achy like Randolph's, though I knew it was only in my head. I limped to my closet, wishing I had my uncle's cane. I got dressed and retrieved my phone from the kitchenette. The screen read 7:02 p.m. I was late for Valhalla's nightly feast. I'd never taken so long to resurrect after dying in battle. Usually I was one of the first ones reborn. I remembered Alex Fierro standing over me, calmly slicing off my head with her garrote. I checked my texts. Still nothing from Annabeth. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I kept hoping. I needed my cousin's outside perspective right now, her smarts, her assurance that I could handle all the weirdness. My door blew open. 3 ravens flew in, spiraled around my head, then landed in the lowest branch of the atrium tree. They glared at me the way only ravens can do, like I was not worthy of being their roadkill dinner. I know, I'm late, I told them. I just woke up.
Caw! Caw! Caw!
Most likely, translation, get moving, stupid. Samira would be at the feast. Maybe I could talk to her. I grabbed my neck chain and slipped it over my head. The runestone pendant felt comfortingly warm against my collarbone, as though Jack were trying to reassure me. Or maybe he was just in a good mood after an enjoyable date with a fine spear. Either way, I was glad to have him back. I got the feeling I wouldn't be using a practice sword for the next 5 days. Things were about to get Jack-worthy. Chapter 10. The Most Awkward Viking Luau Ever. As if Dragon Thursday wasn't bad enough, it was also theme night in the feast hall, Hawaiian Luau.
Ugh.
I understood that the management needed to keep things interesting, especially for warriors who had been waiting here for Doomsday since the Middle Ages. Still, the Luau seemed a little cultural appropriation-y to me. Vikings were notorious for appropriating from other cultures, also for pillaging and burning said cultures. Besides, Seeing thousands of Inheriar in Hawaiian shirts and flower leis was like getting a neon paint grenade between the eyes. The feast hall was packed right up to the nosebleed section. Hundreds of tables arranged like stadium seating, all facing the central court, where a tree as big as the Prudential Center spread its branches across the vast domed roof. Near its roots, turning on a spit above the fire pit, was our usual dinner. The carcass of Saemrimnir, the feast beast, who tonight wore a lovely necklace of orchids. Stuffed in his mouth was a pineapple the size of Wisconsin. Valkyries flew back and forth across the hall, filling pitchers, serving food, and somehow managing to avoid setting their grass skirts on fire in the tiki torches that flickered along the aisles. "Magnus!" TJ called, waving me over. His rifle was propped next to him, the broken stock patched up with duct tape. We didn't have assigned tables. That would have cut down on the fun of fighting each other for the best seats. Tonight, my hallmates had scored a great location on the third tier, a few rows from the Thane's table. "There's our sleepy boy," Halfborn grinned, his teeth flecked with roasted Saemrimnir. "Alucard, my friend." Mallory elbowed him.
"It's aloha, moron,"
she rolled her eyes at me. "Alucard is Norse for fatso, as Halfborn knows perfectly well." "Close enough." Halfborn pounded his goblet to get the Valkyrie's attention. "Some mead and meat for my friend." I took a seat between Mallory and TJ. Soon I had a cold mug of mead and a hot plate of Saemrimnir with biscuits and gravy. Despite all the craziness I'd gone through today, I had a huge appetite. Getting resurrected always did that to me. I dug in. Sitting at the Thane's table was the usual assortment of famous dead people. I recognized Jim Bowie, Crispus Attucks, and Ernie Pyle, all of whom had died bravely in combat, along with Helgi, the hotel manager, and some other ancient Viking dudes. The central throne for Odin was empty, as usual. Sam supposedly received orders from the Allfather once in a while, but Odin hadn't appeared in person since the end of our quest back in January. Probably he was working on his next book, 5 Days to Your Best Ragnarok Ever, and the accompanying PowerPoint presentation. To the left of the Thanes was the Table of Honor. Tonight, it was occupied by only two people, Alex Fierro and her Valkyrie sponsor, Samira Alabas. This meant that, in all the 9 worlds, in the last 24 hours, only Alex had died a death worthy of Valhalla. That wasn't necessarily unusual. The nightly numbers ranged from 0 to 12. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that nobody else had died bravely today merely because they didn't want to share a table with Alex. 2 Valkyrie guards stood behind her as if ready to prevent an escape attempt. Sam's body language looked pretty stiff. I was too far away to hear, but I imagined her conversation with Alex was something like, "Sam, awkward." Alex, "Awkward, awkward." Sam nodding, "Awkward, awkward, awkward." Next to me, TJ pushed away his empty plate. "Some combat today. I've never seen anyone do that." He drew a line across his neck. "So quick and cold." I resisted the urge to touch my throat. "First time I've been decapitated."
"Not fun, is it?" Mallory said.
"What was going on with you, steaming and threatening to explode like that?" I'd known my hallmates a while now. I trusted them like family. And I mean like Annabeth family, not Uncle Randolph family. I told them everything. Loki in his ghastly green tuxedo inviting me to a wedding, the dreams about my uncle, Hearth and Blitz, and the giant siblings in the bar.
"Thrym!"
Halfborn Gunderson picked some biscuit out of his beard.
"I know that name from the old legends. He was one of the Earth Giant Kings. But it couldn't be the same guy. That Thrym was killed, good and proper, centuries ago."
I thought about Otis the Goat, who could supposedly reform from the mist of Gidingagap. "Giants don't, like, resurrect." Halfborn scoffed.
"Not that I've ever heard of. Probably this is another Thrym. It's a common name. Still, if he has Thor's hammer..."
"We should probably not spread the news that it's missing," I said.
"Too right," Mallory grumbled. "You say this giant plans on marrying..."
Her finger drifted in the direction of Samira. "Does Sam know about this scheme?" "I need to ask her," I said. "Either way, we've got 5 days. Then, if this giant Thrym doesn't get his bride..." "He jumps on the telegraph," TJ said. "And he tells all the other giants that he's got Thor's hammer. Then they invade Midgard." I decided not to remind TJ that no one used telegraphs anymore. Halfborn picked up his steak knife and started cleaning his teeth.
"Don't understand why this Thrym fella waited so long. If he's had the hammer for months, why aren't we already under attack?"
I didn't have an answer, but I imagined it had something to do with Loki. As always, he would be whispering in people's ears, manipulating events from behind the scenes. Whatever Loki wanted from this weird marriage transaction, I was sure of one thing.
He wasn't trying to get Thor's hammer back just because he was a swell guy. I stared across the hall at Alex Fierro. I remembered what she had said on the battlefield when we faced Grimwolf. He sent it for me. He knows I'm here. Mallory nudged me. You're thinking the same thing, eh? Can't be a coincidence that Alex Fierro arrived in the midst of all this. You think Loki sent her? I felt like the bathtub goldfish was wriggling its way back down my throat. How could Loki arrange for someone to become an Inheri? Oh, my friend. TJ shook his head. The combination of his floral-patterned Hawaiian shirt with his Union Army jacket made him look like a detective from Hawaii 5-0 1862. How could Loki release an Elder Lindworm into Valhalla? How could he help Johnny Reb win the first battle of Bull Run? Loki did what? My point is, Loki can do many things, TJ said. Don't ever underestimate him. It was good advice. Still, staring at Alex Fierro, I had trouble believing she was a spy. Terrifying and dangerous, yes. A pain in the loincloth, sure. But working for her father? Wouldn't Loki pick somebody who... blended in a little more? I asked. Besides, when Loki was in my head, he told me not to bring Alex to this wedding. He said she would ruin everything. Reverse psychology, Halfborn suggested, still working the knife between his teeth. Mallory snorted. What do you know about psychology, you oaf? Or reverse psychology, Halfborn wriggled his brushy eyebrows. That Loki is a tricky one. Mallory threw a baked potato at him. All I'm saying is that Alex Fierro bears watching. After she killed the Lindworm, with a little help from me, TJ added. She disappeared into the woods. She left TJ and me to fend for ourselves. Then the rest of the dragons descended on us out of nowhere. And killed us, TJ said. Yes, that was a little odd. Halfborn grunted. Fierro is a child of Loki, and an Augur. You can't trust an Augur in combat. Mallory swatted his arm. Your attitude is more offensive than your smell. I find your offense offensive, Halfborn protested. Augurs aren't warriors, that's all I meant. Okay, what is an Augur? I asked. When you first said it, I thought it was a monster. Then I thought maybe it was another word for pirate, like one who args. Does it mean a transgender person, or what? Literally, it means unmanly, Mallory said. It's a deadly insult among big, loutish Vikings like this guy, she poked Halfborn in the chest. Bah, said Halfborn. It's only an offense if you call someone Augur who isn't Augur. Gender-fluid people are hardly a new thing, Magnus. There were plenty of Augur among the Norse. They served their purposes. Some of the greatest priests and sorcerers were... He made circles in the air with his steak knife. You know. Mallory frowned at me. My boyfriend is a Neanderthal. Not at all, Halfborn said. I'm an enlightened modern man from the year 865 CE. Now, if you talk to those in Harriar from 700 CE, well... They're not as open-minded about such things. TJ sipped his mead, his eyes fixed in the distance. During the war, we had a scout from the Lenape tribe. Called himself, or herself, Mother William. That's an awful war name, Halfborn complained. Who would tremble in terror before someone called Mother William? TJ shrugged. I'll admit most of us didn't know what to make of him. His identity seemed to change day to day. He said he had two spirits in his body, one male and one female. But I'm telling you, great scout. Saved us from an ambush during the march through Georgia. I watched Alex eat her dinner, gingerly picking pieces of carrot and potato from her plate. It was hard to believe that a few hours ago those same delicate fingers had taken down a dragon and cut off my head with a wire. Halfborn leaned toward me. There's no shame in being attracted, Magnus. I choked on a piece of feast beast. What? No, I wasn't... Staring? Halfborn grinned. You know, Frey's priests were very fluid. During the Harvest Festival, they used to wear dresses and do some amazing dances. You're messing with me, I said. Nope, Halfborn chuckled. One time in Uppsala, I met this lovely... His story was cut short by the sound of horns echoing through the hall. At the Thane's table, Helgi rose. Since this morning, he'd repaired his suit jacket and clipped his beard, but he was now wearing an oversized war helmet. Probably to hide the damage Alex Fierro had done to his dead buzzard hairdo. In Harriar, his voice boomed. Tonight, only one fallen warrior has joined us. But I'm told the story of his death is quite impressive. He scowled at Samira Al-Abbas as if to say, it had better be.
Rise, Alex Fierro, and dazzle us with your glorious deeds.
Chapter 11. What's a guy gotta do to get a standing ovation? Alex didn't look excited about having to dazzle us. She rose, tugging at her sweater vest, then scanned the crowd as if challenging each and every warrior to a duel.
"Alex, son of Loki," Helgi began.
"Daughter," Alex corrected him. "Unless I tell you otherwise, it's daughter."
At the end of the Thane's table, Jim Bowie coughed into his mead cup.
"What now?"
Ernie Pyle muttered something in Bowie's ear. They put their heads together. Pyle brought out his journalist's notepad and a pen. He seemed to be drawing Bowie a diagram. Helgi's face twitched.
"As you wish. Daughter of Loki."
"And don't feel obliged to mention my dad," Alex added. "I don't like him very much."
A ripple of nervous laughter went around the room. Next to Alex, Samira clenched her fists as if warming up her strangling muscles. I doubted she was mad at Alex. Sam didn't like Loki either. But if for any reason the Thanes decided Alex wasn't a worthy choice for Valhalla, Sam could get kicked out of the Valkyries and exiled to Midgard. I knew this because that's what had happened when she'd introduced me.
"Very well, person who is the child of some parent."
Helgi's voice was as dry as Odin's empty eye socket.
"Let us watch your exploits, courtesy of Valkyrie Vision."
These Vikings today and their newfangled technology. Around the trunk of the tree Laerdir, huge holographic screens winked into existence. Footage from Samira's Valkyrie body cam began to play. Sam was an expert at trigonometry, calculus, and aviation, so you'd think she could figure out how to use a camera.
Nope.
She always forgot when to turn it on and off. Half the time her videos came out sideways because she'd clipped the camera on wrong. Sometimes she recorded entire missions where the camera showed nothing but her own nostrils. Tonight, the video quality was good, but Sam had started recording way too early. Timestamp, 7:03 that morning. We were treated to a view of her grandparents' living room, a small but tidy space with a low coffee table and two suede sofas. Over the fireplace hung a framed piece of Arabic calligraphy, a swirling gold ink design on white parchment. Proudly displayed on the mantle underneath were pictures of Sam as a toddler with a toy plane, as a middle schooler on the soccer field, and as a high schooler holding a large trophy. As soon as Sam realized where the video had started, she stifled a yelp, but there was nothing she could do to stop it. The video pan left to a dining area where three older people sat drinking tea from fancy gold-rimmed teacups. One guy I knew, Abdel Fadlan, the owner of Fadlan's Falafel. There was no mistaking his mane of silver hair and that tailored blue business suit. The other two must have been Sam's grandparents, Gide and Bibi. Gide looked like Santa Claus or Ernest Hemingway, barrel-chested and moon-faced with a snowy beard and lots of smile wrinkles, though today he was frowning. He wore a gray suit that had probably fit him 20 years and 20 pounds ago. Bibi wore an elegantly embroidered red and gold dress with a matching hijab. She sat with perfect poise, like royalty, as she poured tea for her guest, Mr. Fadlan. From the angle of the camera, I guess Samira was sitting on a chair between the two sofas. About 10 feet away, in front of the fireplace, Amir Fadlan paced in agitation, running his hands through his slick, dark hair. He looked as dashing as always in his skinny jeans, white t-shirt, and stylish vest. But his usual easy smile was gone. His expression was anguished, like someone had stomped on his heart.
"Sam, I don't understand," he said. "I love you."
The entire crowd in the feast hall went, "Ooh!"
"Shut up!"
Samira snapped at them, which only made them laugh. I could see that it was taking all her willpower not to cry. The video fast-forwarded. I watched as Sam flew to meet me at the Thinking Cup, then got a message on her phone for a possible code 381. She flew from the coffee shop and sped across the park toward Downtown Crossing. She spiraled down and floated over a dark, dead-end alley between two dilapidated theaters. I knew exactly where it was, right around the corner from a homeless shelter. Heroin junkies like to shoot up in that alley, which made it a great place to get beaten, robbed, or killed. At the moment Sam arrived, it was also a great place to get attacked by vicious, glowing wolves. Against the back wall, three large beasts had cornered a grizzled homeless guy. The only thing between him and certain death was a Roach Brothers shopping cart filled with cans for recycling. My dinner congealed in my gut. The wolves brought back too many memories of my mother's murder. Even if they hadn't been the size of full-grown horses, I would have known they weren't regular Midgard wolves. Blue, phosphorescent mist clung to their fur, throwing aquarium-like ripples of light across the brick walls. Their faces were too expressive, with human-like eyes and sneering lips. These were the children of Fenris. They padded back and forth, snarling and sniffing the air, enjoying the scent of fear coming from their prey.
Back, the old man croaked, jabbing his grocery cart toward the animals. I told you, I don't want it. I don't believe in it.
In the feast hall, the assembled Inheriar muttered with disapproval. I heard stories about some modern demigods, sons and daughters of Norse gods or goddesses who refused to accept their destiny. They turned their backs on the weirdness of the Nine Worlds. Instead of fighting when monsters appeared, they ran and hid. Some decided they were legitimately crazy. They took meds. They checked themselves into hospitals. Others became alcoholics or junkies and ended up on the streets. This guy must have been one of them. I could feel the pity and disgust in the feast hall. This old man might have spent his whole life running, but now he was trapped. Rather than come to Valhalla as a hero, he would die a coward's death and go to the cold land of hell, the worst fate any Inheriar could imagine. Then, at the mouth of the alley, a voice yelled, Hey! Alex Fierro had arrived. She stood with her feet planted apart, her fists on her waist like Supergirl, if Supergirl had green hair and sported a pink and green sweater vest. Alex must have been passing by. Maybe she heard the old man shouting or the wolves growling. There was no reason she had to get involved. The wolves were so focused on their prey, they never would have noticed her. Yet she charged the beasts, morphing as she moved and launching herself into battle as a German shepherd. Despite the size difference, Alex managed to knock the largest wolf off its feet. She sank her fangs into its neck. The beast writhed and snarled, but Alex jumped away before it could bite back. As the wounded wolf staggered, the other two attacked her. As quick as flowing water, Alex changed back to human form. She lashed out with her wire, using it like a whip. With a single flick, one of the wolves lost its head.
Ooh, the audience said with appreciation.
Before she could strike again, the other wolf tackled her. The two of them rolled across the alley. Alex changed to a German shepherd again, clawing and biting, but she was out of her weight class. Turn into something bigger, I found myself murmuring. But for whatever reason, Alex didn't. I'd always liked dogs, more than I liked most people, and definitely more than wolves. It was hard to watch as the wolf tore into the German shepherd, ripping at Alex's snout and throat, matting her fur with blood. Finally, Alex managed to change form, shrinking into a lizard and skittering out from under her attacker. She turned human again a few feet away, her clothes in tatters, her face a horror show of slashes and bite marks. Unfortunately, the first wolf had recovered its wits. It howled in rage, a sound that echoed through the alley and ricocheted off the surrounding buildings. I realized it was the same howl I'd heard from across town while I fought the goat assassin. Together, the two remaining wolves advanced toward Alex, their blue eyes flickering with hatred. Alex fumbled with the sweater tied around her waist. One reason she wore it became evident. It concealed a hunting knife at her belt. She drew the weapon and tossed it toward the homeless guy.